All right, everybody, welcome back to another exciting, action-packed, dare I say, high-caliber episode here of the Crypto 101 podcast. I am your co-host, Bryce Paul, as always, joined by my good buddy across the country, Mr. Brendan Veman. Brendan, how goes it today in the sunny state of Florida?
Well, it's not so sunny today, but you know, we're entering into hurricane season, but everything's good, man. We're having a good time over here. The crypto market is on fire. And we're starting to see a little bit of fall in that pesky Bitcoin dominance that has been bugging the altcoin market for a little bit now. So all things considered, Bryce, I'm doing fantastic and I'm stoked for another pod.
Yeah, we'll definitely hunker down there. I guess, you know, during these stormy seasons, you just don't want to go outside. But what better way to not go outside is just, you know, spend time inside crushing this bull market. There are so many exciting protocols and new networks that are coming out. And we have some incredible guests here on the show. I'm really excited to speak with Naris Protocol founder and CEO David Carvajal, as well as the chief of strategy David Holtzman. We're graced with both of your presence, David and David. David Carvajal will say hi to you first so the audience knows which David you are, the CEO and founder, and then David Holtzman will go to you next.
Awesome. Pleasure to be here. Hello, everybody.
And Mr. Holtzman, how goes it?
Everything's fine.
Hello. I love it. No, we're excited to dive into Naris Protocol. You guys are doing some really incredible stuff in the sort of the cybersecurity world. And we want to just get acquainted with your backgrounds before we dive into the protocol. David Carvajal, give us a little brief on who you are and how you came to be the founder of Naris Protocol.
Sure. I'll give you a quick one. So I'm originally from Portugal. My background is in cryptography and also in cybersecurity. So I've been a cybersecurity researcher for more than 20 years. I've been an ethical hacker for 25 years. And I've been global chief security for a number of multi-billion dollar companies, both in Europe and also in the UK, mainly kind of like highly regulated spaces, airports, things like this. And I've been advising a number of supranational institutions and also nation states on cyber warfare, cyber espionage, data protection, cyber terrorism mitigation, and many other areas that tend to be critical to countries, mainly under the European Union and the NATO umbrella. Wow. And it was in connection to these environments or these centers that former leaders of these areas thought this was a good idea. And I decided to leave corporate and dedicate my this which is now my life to Naris Protocol.
Wow, incredible! So fighting off like all the bad guys, basically in cyberspace, it sounds like as an ethical hacker and a national security advisor, I got to ask just out of the gate here, what kind of keeps you up at night, knowing what you know about the underbelly of cybersecurity?
Well, what keeps me up at night, there's two main areas. One is the fact that all cybersecurity in the world is centralized. So the whole world is a collection of single points of failure that are just waiting to be dominated or taken over that will lead to access to everything they're connected to. And that's not changing unless Web3 becomes the backbone of this. Wow. And the other part of it is just the fact, you know, talking about Web3 more directly. So, for example, blockchain themselves, they provide or they promise immutability and protection against double spend and all of that. And quantum technology threatens that promise unless we act now. So it's the whole cryptographic backbone of blockchains, but also in the real world, everything from like nuclear secrets to, you know, blockchains themselves and consensus mechanisms is completely based on the cryptographic standard that quantum computers threaten. And we are completely resilient to, and that's one of the backbones of what we're doing.
Wow. Yeah. Quantum resistance is going to be huge. Mr. David Holtzman, we want to dive into a little bit about how you came to being chief of strategy here at Naris Protocol, a little bit about your background. And then I just think for fun, I'll toss the same question to you at the end of what keeps you up at night as a cybersecurity expert.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation while they collect dust? And credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With Gemini Credit Card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight into your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, or you're a faithful listener of the Crypto 101 podcast and love Bitcoin and other cryptos, visit the Gemini credit card website so it's easy for you to earn even more Bitcoin or crypto with their credit card. Again, visit Gemini.com/card today to learn more. Have you ever wanted to trade Bitcoin but haven't dared tried? With Plus 500 Futures, you can trade crypto without the hassle of opening a wallet. With just a few clicks, you can register and start practicing with their free and unlimited demo. See a trading opportunity? You'll be able to trade in just two clicks. Feel ready? You can move to real money with as little as $100 once your account is approved. And the great thing is that in addition to crypto, Plus 500 gives you access to a wide range of instruments like the S&P 500, NASDAQ, gas, and much more. Explore equity indices like energy, metals, Forex, and beyond. With a simple and intuitive platform, you can trade anytime, anywhere. Experience the fast, accessible futures trading you've been waiting for with Plus 500. With over 20 years of experience, Plus 500 is your gateway to the markets. Visit us.plus500.com to learn more. Trading in futures involves risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone. Not all applicants will qualify, and this is not personal financial advice. Plus 500, it's trading with a plus. Attention, cigar enthusiasts. Today, we're thrilled to introduce to you Cigar Bid, America's number one online cigar auction site. If you're looking for unbeatable deals on every type of cigar, listen up. At Cigar Bid, you have the power to set your own price, often scoring top quality cigars and accessories at prices much lower than retail. Others want you to believe they are always giving you their best deal, but at Cigar Bid, you get to decide the deal. It's the cigar site the rest of the industry does not want you to know about. Score deals at the best prices every single day. The live auctions are fast-paced and exciting, making every bid a thrilling experience. Check out Freefall to watch the prices drop in real time, or the Power Hour for our fastest-paced auctions. Cigar Bid has a text update, so you get notified when you're outbid and get exclusive deals right to you. And if bidding is not your thing, then no problem at all, because you can buy the cigars straight up at awesome low prices as well. So no matter what you're looking for, you'll find it at Cigar Bid. So if you're ready to enjoy the fun and the convenient way to purchase fine cigars at great prices online, visit cigarbid.com/crypto101. That's cigarbid.com/crypto101. Happy bidding.
Sure. My background's different than David's. There's some similarities. I started a long time ago as I was an intelligence agent, spoke Russian. I was a cryptographer, worked for the National Security Agency, and I was a submariner. And I spent 4 years at the end of the Cold War, and I spoke Russian, so you can kind of guess what was going on there. the wall fell. I realized that was a bad job prospect. I'd been using computers anyway, picked up degrees in computers, and I was basically became one of the early internet guys in the 80s. I was a chief scientist at IBM. I ran research at Booz Allen and Hamilton and a couple other things. And then I ended up at a company called Network Solutions in the mid 90s. And they're a small company, less than 100 people. And the internet was just kicking off. The commercial internet was just kicking off. But this company ran the domain name system. Yeah. So I joined as CTO, and then I ran the domain name system. And then the dot-com bubble happened. So when I got there, there were like 75,000 domain names. When I left, there were 10 million. And that's the bubble. And I watched just everything go crazy. We had no security. I ran a data center that had the root servers of the internet in it. And I mean, you could just pull the plug and the whole internet would just stop. And because we did it once by accident, so I know that. We didn't even have locks on the doors. It was just a warehouse, with just plain old Yale locks. So everything changed then, because people started becoming aware of what the internet was. And I had to explain it to almost every single member of Congress. They took bus tours down to where my data center was, and I would explain it 80 or 90 at a time. And I'm sure things have changed, but back in the mid to late 90s, they were dumb as rocks. out of like 400 and some people, they asked the most ignorant, stupid questions about the internet that, I mean, if we had time, I could tell you just horrible, horrible things. And this is why we don't have any legislation yet about any of this. And as crypto guys, I think we can all be thankful for that.
Yeah.
They don't know how to do it. So anyway, so I Y2K happened. During Y2K, I was running the root servers of the internet and the entire domain name system. I designed the new domain name system registration, and I built it. And this goes back to what David was saying. I built it to be decentralized because during this whole period, I came to really dislike the idea of centralized switching for authentication. Because in the non-digital world, you know, big deal. But as the digital world starts to emerge, I mean, that if you're centralized, you can control everyone. So I designed the domain name registration system so that that's not completely feasible. But when, you know, we can talk about this later, but and this kind of goes into the question you wanted me to answer anyway. But when you look at a lot of these big data breaches, they're almost never the company whose name gets attached to it, like Equifax, Office of Personnel Management,
Target and Yahoo.
Target and Yahoo, right. TJ Maxx got hit. Yeah. So it's never them. It's a service provider because they all outsource security issues. They outsource point of sale stuff. They outsource authentication. And then these guys screw up and they're always some little company in, you know, Ohio or something that you've never heard of. And they basically hack off half the United States. We're talking hundreds of millions of people on some of these hacks. That's what keeps me up tonight, because I don't think people understand that. And that's what we're doing at Norris. And that's why I wanted to come and help David, because, and he'll talk more about it, but the technology he's designed is brilliant and it supports this capability.
You're talking about traditional sort of cybersecurity relying on, and both of you guys have kind of alluded to this centralization factor that is just like horrifying. And you're just like, you know, we got to kind of wake up the average everyday person to the fact that there's so many security vulnerabilities in our banking system or e-commerce system or you name it. Pretty much everything relies on this internet architecture that's centralized. And I'll let both of you guys kind of take a crack at this from different angles, but you know, how is decentralization, which is a core, you know, tenant of everything crypto related that we've talked on this podcast for like, you know, 10 years, you know, what is decentralization in this capacity and why is it so much better for critical infrastructure?
Well, mine is going to be philosophical and slightly anarchistic.
Okay.
So the whole centralization, decentralization thing, it's kind of a red herring, because what we're talking about underneath is the degree of governmental control over our lives. So centralized anything makes it a lot easier to control you. Blockchain, by its very nature, takes many, many things out of the hands of people who want to dick with it. And I think that's great. I mean, I would much rather have, symmetrical keys, you know, have a private and a public key system where I control my own private key than have to give a password to Google or Microsoft or Amazon, because they are the government. I mean, in the 21st century, I mean, you know, Elon Musk is the richest guy in the world. These people control everything. Mm-hmm. So I believe that this is, it's a political thing and it's a freedom thing. And if we want to be free and we want to have the ability to say what we're thinking and to own cryptocurrencies without having to report every single thing you have to the government, which you know is coming, you know, you need decentralization. There's just no way around it. Oh, and by the way, as an added benefit, When you add smart contracts in on blockchains, you're basically getting rid of about 80% of all the lawyers.
Which is a good thing.
I said there's a little bit of anarchy in that answer. But
what's your take, Mr. Carvalho?
Well, I'm pretty much aligned with everything David said. I would be happy to press the libertarian, anarchist part of it as well, more, but I'll just give it maybe a different perspective and explain a little bit the context of Norris Protocol and why. So the reason why is important because, every system, every piece of hardware, every application, every service, every API, anything that does anything digitally is a centralized thing, unfortunately. So blockchains themselves, they are not magical, right? They don't operate in the atmosphere, on top of nothing, right? They are running on top of centralized systems themselves. So they're running on servers in the cloud, on validators on people's homes, whatever, right? These are all central points of failure to the environments where they operate. They can be hacked, keys can be stolen, the same thing with wallets, same thing with exchanges, so on and so forth. There's no difference between the centralized environments and this because these are centralized environments. The only difference is that blockchains are the decentralization side of things under consensus and under a strong cryptographic standard that right now is under threat because of quantum, right? And it's very backbone or foundation. So that's a good idea, and that's much better than centralization. But the principle is that every device is a single point of failure to everything it is connected to is a very bad principle, right? And that hasn't changed ever. So I think for the first time, we have the opportunity to change this, this primitive, let's say, this fundamental issue by applying, a very resilient post-quantum cryptographic standard on top of everything that runs, that, could be hardware, could be software, could be anything. And we can prove its state for the first time under consensus. So as it is operating, for example, say a wallet, and I want to make transactions with this wallet or make logins with the wallet, or it could be a banking application, could be anything. You want it to be in a trusted state as it operates, right? And you want that to be transparent and very resilient. So that's really what the Norris Protocol has created. We are a sub-layer zero, we call it the sub-zero layer, post-quantum infrastructure for Web3 and Web2. So it's a native Web3 infrastructure that was designed to secure the entire blockchain stack as we know it, and also outside of blockchains, because any digital system is a potential blockchain with our ecosystem, from future quantum threats and existing centralized threats. So without requiring any hard forks. So that means that any other chain can actually use this without going back and hard forking and making every transaction since the beginning of time and many other complexities. So we combine kind of like the decentralized ethos of Web3 with real world proven security principles that are the most mature areas, obviously backed by a number of NATO level, commands, let's say, or directions or mandates. Basically, the technology itself, it meets the toughest standards in the real world, which is something that blockchains are missing, because in general, even if you look at, say, fundamental cryptography in blockchains, we're looking at like 256 bits, which is 32 bytes, right? If you multiply or divide by 8. That's really low, even compared to, for example, your traditional VPN at home, which will probably be working at, RSA 2048, which is 10 times more. And of course, there is the consensus mechanism that makes it more resilient. However, when quantum comes into the picture, all of that goes out of the window, right? And the consensus mechanism doesn't matter anymore, because the fundamental cryptography that's, maintaining the blockchain and signing the transactions and all these things is at threat, right? It's under risk. So our focus is on empowering Web3 through this technology to be the backbone for everything, from on-chain finance to real-world enterprise applications, supporting security through Web3. So that basically any centralized or decentralized infrastructure becomes, exponentially more resilient through Web3, even without knowing that Web3 is present. right? Mm-hmm. So the objective is to make, you know, every application, process, service, piece of hardware part of a consensus that validates the state of every other, right? In a very resilient post-quantum way.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to add a small thing on what he said. The looking at business and economics, it's not going back again. So this Web 2, Web 3, you know, distinction we're talking about, you know, we're close enough, we can talk about it now. Web 2 is going away. Mm. And quantum is coming in, whether we like it or not. And that means post-quantum is coming. So, you know, you might as well deal with it. And that's kind of part of the message. And most of the small governments we've talked to actually completely get this, which I think is fascinating. Mm. And that we've had a lot of success. David's on the road all the time dealing with these guys. And it's because of that. So it's inevitable.
I'm curious, how far away do you think that quantum computing is? Because it seems like different people in the space have a different idea of, you know, maybe this is farther, maybe this is closer than we think. I've seen people say maybe 15 years on the short side, maybe 30 years on the far side. But then, you know, with AI, you have to think that that timeline and that process has accelerated.
So I have a much more aggressive view about that. So I published some papers on the idea. You know, obviously we are very well connected to a number of, agencies that work with us, and they also have intelligence about these sort of things. Obviously, I'm not going to reveal details, but the fact is that we're a lot closer. Like if you look a lot, when I say a lot, it's like, you know, caps lock a lot.
caps lock
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah. Like if you look, for example, at most tier one countries and their, for example, their 2030 plans. And, you know, from a technological perspective, they all include quantum in some way. They include quantum resistant, they include quantum cryptography, they include quantum. And even the US and the European Union, very recently, the last year and again this year, they have passed laws saying that all government-connected entities that work with the government need to be post-quantum resilient by 2030. But this is what's public by 2030. What's private is a whole different story. Now, just to give an idea, Xi Jinping himself said, quantum is a strategic technology for this country, and it's not by chance that, you know, China is investing more in quantum than they are with, for example, with their nuclear program. And that tells you how strategic that is, right? And it's the same kind of investment from the US and Europe combined, what's happening in China. Having said that, quantum computers are in constant evolution. So as David likes to say, they are not a theory, they are real. And they are not, theoretical. They are an engineering problem. So in other words, you throw enough people at it, enough brains at it, you're going to solve this problem. There's constant innovations on the way of how, you know, how to solve quantum computing scalability issues that basically exponentially puts us close to that Q day, right? So there's two points I want to make. One is Q day is a lot closer than what you think it is. Second, it is a survivability event. It's kind of like quantum is coming for blockchain and for the real world, like the asteroid has come for the dinosaurs. Okay. And the only difference is that the dinosaurs didn't know what that thing was. We actually know and we see it coming, and it's a survivability event. And it's besides being a lot closer, the only way that you can actually, prevent what's coming is so that is by being resilient now. There's this whole thing about that's called harvest now, the crypt later, and that's the point that I want to make about the moment that Q day being now or in 12 months or in 2 years is not the issue. The issue is that your data, your transactions, your keys, your signatures are being captured right now, and they're being stored in somebody else's hard drive. Right. And it could be for Web3 or for other purposes like espionage or whatever. Right. And it's all based on the same cryptography that quantum computers are really good at breaking. And once it's in somebody else's hard drive, there's nothing you can do about that. And it's just waiting for the moment that they can all be broken pretty much simultaneously. And that access will be given to that threat actor. Now, the only way for it to prevent that is to be quantum resilient now, because that stuff is being harvested now. And this is my point about, you know, the Q day being irrelevant. It doesn't matter if it's in 1 year or in 2 years or three or in 6 months, because your data is already somewhere else. And guess what? Nobody ever does. Nobody changes keys. But not only that, the backbone of the infrastructures. So if you think, for example, you know, Bitcoin itself, or, you know, other cryptographic spaces that hold nuclear secrets or whatever, is not going to change, right? So we need to change it now for it to be resilient into the future. Otherwise, you won't survive it. So we're not preparing for the quantum future right now. We're already defending against it. And you'll see quotes from, you know, IBM, top people and other people saying that this is happening now. You need to be, you know, secure against it now. Those warrant won't survive it. Like, the only post-quantum defenses that can see quantum attacks coming are quantum resistance. In other words, yeah, quantum attacks don't knock, they bypass. That you won't even know that this has happened.
Yeah, there's also a misguided viewpoint that I have seen for decades in technology. And this misguided viewpoint is that technology increases linearly. It does not increase linearly. It has jumps, right? Mm-hmm. And a perfect example of that is the whole generative AI stuff. It caught me by surprise. I mean, I thought when I first started messing around with ChatGPT, I said, holy crap, this is a lot better than I thought it would be at this point. Mm-hmm. And now everybody's using it for all kinds of crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And the adoption curve is probably exponential. It is not linear. So I think that same model applies to quantum computing, because now there is a very good reason what David's talking about, resilience and store and harvest and all that. I mean, these are things that are going to just push it along. It is an engineering problem, and people know how to solve engineering problems. They innovate, and once there's enough money at stake, I mean, you know, it's going to be something. My guess is it's going to follow the same path of Moore's law, which is, you know, doubling the number of transistors every 18 months. I think it's going to be something like that, because right now we're already at about, I don't know, David probably knows, but about 1,200 qubits, I think. Mm-hmm. It's something like that for the most public quantum computer. And if they're announcing, that's like Google or something. So if they're announcing that, then you figure NSA, who lies or doesn't admit things, probably has an order of magnitude more. So they probably have, I don't know, 10,000, 20,000 qubits. And you need supposedly 1 million to have a completely working quantum computer. And I don't believe that either. I think 100,000 is probably plenty. And they'll get rid of the rest by extrapolating in software. And also, to their benefit, everybody's got all these NVIDIA chips that are being accelerated because of the AI stuff. I mean, half of the world's electricity output is quickly going into running NVIDIA chips. And, you know, and it all started with Bitcoin mining, and now it's going into AI, and it's going to go from there right into quantum computing.
Yeah. Since we are about crypto, I just want to say something. Yeah, you're about right on the qubits. There's like different ways how, you know, the fault tolerance exists and how they are used for logic and so on. But if you're looking at, for example, you know, say breaking ECDSA, the elliptic curve digital signature algorithm used, for example, by Bitcoin, right? Or really by all chains. When signing a transaction, which is the weakest part, you actually create a hash, which is public. Right. And that gets, you know, sent for the validators. Right. That's the weakest part of it. you could actually break a single Bitcoin private key once the signature is visible, theoretically, with like 1,500. We have 1,250 publicly, right? I would argue we're very, very close to this. We're talking like minutes to hours. So assuming that one logical qubit is like 1,000 or 10,000 physical qubits because of error calculation, and you know that the algorithm, right, there's Shor's algorithm, there's other algorithms that are potentials too, and I'm sure your point, Bryce, about AI was pretty good because AI is going to get us better algorithms, right? And if this algorithm is just 10 times better, then, or 100 times better, then we're not talking about one key, we're talking about all keys instantaneously, right, at the same time. And that's not just Bitcoin, that would be for everything, right? The just kind of like to leave you with a quote that I remember from, I think it was somebody in the NSA, the impact of adversarial use of a quantum computer would be absolutely devastating to all national security objectives and our nation and any existing sub-processes. So, critical infrastructure, power, whatever. It would be equivalent to like an EMP attack potentially, or worse. The implications to blockchain, as I mentioned, are absolute because everything is crypto. That's why it's called crypto, right? Everything is cryptography.
It almost reminds me a little bit of like splitting the atom, like the Manhattan Project. You're like, okay, well, what good is going to come from this, right? Like, sure, you could use it now for like atomic energy or nuclear energy. Like, we learned a lot about good, positive stuff for humanity that came from the Manhattan Project, but also, it destroyed and lots of lives and created like nuclear warfare and all that kind of stuff. So I guess my question is, what good is going to come from quantum, and will that outweigh the bad? And is there like a way to kind of put the rails on this stuff?
Can I answer that pretty quickly? Well, and then you go there. You go.
Okay. Oh, well, if you integrate, see, quantum is not going to exist in a vacuum. So quantum computing added to generative AI running on, 40 billion dollar, racks of NVIDIA chips, what can't that do? It can do anything practically. And we're talking a couple years from now. This isn't like the end of the decade. This is 2, 3, 4 years. And oh, by the way, not to get too wacky about this, but if you all know what the singularity is, all of this stuff is going to bring the singularity, when the first computer becomes sentient, the general consensus is it's 2035 or 2040. Elon Musk thought 2030. I think it's going to be 2030, and all this stuff's going to happen. And you mentioned World War II and the atomic bomb. If you look at the state of nuclear physics in 1940, and then realizing when they actually lit off a bomb in early 1945, that was pretty impressive. And that was not a linear innovation curve. And there were other countries doing it. Germany was doing it. There were all these, the whole Heisenberg, Oppenheimer thing that movie sort of captured. We're going to see that. We're going to see it really soon. And it's gonna shake the planet down to its social roots. And the nice thing about that is if it happens, the currency everybody's gonna use is gonna be post-quantum cryptocurrency.
Yeah, we are using that technology, the post-quantum cryptography, for actual validations, right? So if you go, for example, to our testnet, we have done more than 90 million post-quantum transactions already, about 2.6 million wallets. And these are validations of state of things, right? but we're using that in a very resilient way. So for example, let's say you want to, you know, access your wallet safely, let's say your MetaMask or whatever, right? Or your hardware wallet. These are, again, these are centralized points of failure. So if there's some malicious thing that actually tampers with your local MetaMask or with your local wallet, it's game over, right? It's game over for you because, yes, the blockchain is going to validate the transaction, but you didn't make it, right? Or it was triggered by a third party. So there is currently no validation of state for anything anywhere. Just think about this. This is huge. It's like we're basically the whole world is operating on a trust me, bro basis. Yeah.
Trust me, bro basis.
That's it. Like we're sleepwalking into, you know, breaches and anarchy and things that happen and you don't know why. But the logic is like, why the hell shouldn't we have an always on Web3 post quantum proof, like resilient to quantum computers, but also you know that nothing is tempering that truth, right? It's a bit philosophical, but how about the trust over the truth? So you're seeing something on your screen, but how do you know it's true? It's very important for you to actually have a proof that's transparent, that proves that what you're seeing is actually true, because it's coming from a trusted system that's validated by a huge decentralized anonymous environment of potentially billions of devices, maybe, you know, with satellites in space and, you know, on the Earth and so on, that are part of the consensus telling you that, yeah, you can trust that. And if you can trust that, you want to operate it. If you cannot trust it, then you don't want to make this transaction, right? So the parallel that you made between the Manhattan Project and the Quantum Frontier is really interesting because, yes, they brought us nukes, which kills lots of people, but they also brought us nuclear power, right? And potentially nuclear fusion, hopefully, right? Which will be clean, right? They also brought us x-rays so we can see your broken bones, you know, and stuff like that, right? So just like any technology, quantum is dual use, right? And, you know, the parallel is, let's say, yes, creating the Manhattan Project ended up ending World War II, with the bang, right? But quantum computing, if we are not ready, it will break all modern cryptography that will support all secrets, or that is supporting everything that matters in the world right now. So you know, that basically threatens the whole global digital infrastructure. And we are here to support on the security side with decentralized infrastructure, as we mentioned before, as we call it, the sub-zero layer, which is the last frontier that needs to be decentralized, which is infrastructure itself. So this is infrastructure for infrastructure, in stopping quantum from ending privacy and ending your sovereignty, even as a person that creates data and consumes data.
Yeah, I mean, so what it sounds like is, even though the timeline for quantum computing is moving forward, the timeline for quantum resiliency is also moving forward, and that this is a very achievable goal.
Yes.
And so I think that's something that's important for the listeners to understand, because they always see these headlines, they see these fear articles being put out, and it scares them out of a lot of this stuff. But, you know, rest assured, there is a solution. There are people working on this. And as we zoom out to the bigger timeline, which is what I want to do now, you know, what does the success of what both of you are working on in the next like 5 to 10 years look like? And is this protocol meant to integrate quietly everywhere, like maybe in the background, or is it meant to reshape how the world even like thinks about digital security?
Yeah. So I'm sure David has opinions on that. I'll just start with a couple of my own. First of all, I see these as both community-driven and also enterprise-driven. This is obviously, how can I say, until recently, it was military-grade technology. It's very strategic for countries to adopt this. That's why they have these on their 2030 plans, 2040 plans. But from a perspective where we have Web3 and moving into Web4 and other things like that, this is like, I would say it's a fundamental technology. Right. The world is moving on that direction. It's inevitable. And as Brendan was saying, the people are worried and they get afraid. They should be. But at the same time, there are solutions. And post-quantum comes before quantum in terms of integration. What I see in terms of, like, you know, growth and integration with, critical infrastructure, like we're doing, for example, with European Smart Cities Project, with other projects related to governments and government technology and critical infrastructure, it's obvious. Like the use case that is obvious for it. But there is, how can I say, I see the community that we have created, which is, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. I see it as a kind of like the beating heart of this. So people will be able to come in and explore the SDK and build use cases on top of it for whatever, right? Insert use case here, right? And that will lead to an explosion of capability. So what I envision is, like, in 4 or 5 years, is like tens of millions. We already have almost 1 million nodes, but so right now we are the biggest Web3 infrastructure on top of centralized, like, we're decentralizing things. These were computers that were centralized and now they're part of Web3 infrastructure in the world. And what I expect in 5 years is to have hopefully billions of devices participating that will add to the resiliency of everything that humanity wants to do. And as, you know, civilization evolves further and maybe we'll, you know, go to Mars and, you know, go to the moon again and all these things, these should be nodes. They shouldn't be points of failure. They should be all communicating and validating each other, right? So this is what I see. And the people, the community that is driving this, they're going to be the beating heart of the whole ecosystem. They're going to be the anonymous validators that are going to maintain all of this running. You know, again, this is a Web3 backbone for a world that is already decentralized physically. They just don't know about it, or they're doing it wrong, right? So, yeah, that's what I would say.
I love it. I'm curious if like a Coinbase, for instance, was using Narus protocol, would they have been able to avoid any of the recent breach? Because I know that recent breach kind of hits close to home for the crypto industry, as many people were affected by sort of a central point of failure. Or was that just completely something?
Of course. We have written extensively about this. We have had articles published in Forbes and in other environments exactly explaining why and how this would have been mitigated. But because you see, this is just the kind of like the same thing that David was explaining before that happens in the real world. I mean, outside of blockchains, over and over and over again. Because again, these are centralized environments that, yes, they have blockchains, but the blockchains themselves and their environments are centralized that are serving the things. Right. So, yes, there is a key somewhere to be stolen, a system that needs to be infiltrated locally. Right. Or some exploit that needs to happen to a single system that leads to everything being taken over laterally and vertically. And then you don't really own anything anymore. Right. But again, the issue is the point of failure. So if we take that out from a perspective of infrastructure, we are in a much better position resilience wise.
So there's another problem with going off what you're saying on centralized systems that I don't think people talk about very much, which is that it also creates not just vertical vulnerabilities inside their own network, it creates horizontal vulnerabilities because other people are using similar, if not the exact same software. In fact, that's what zero days are all about. Zero days are a menace because if you have one, you don't just get this computer, you get this and this and this and this until the vendor finds out and it becomes a 1 day or a 2 day or something like that. So that with Narus protocol embedded in these things, I think it pretty much wipes out that kind of an impact from zero days.
Just to finalize that, to kind of like make it go around and touch Web3 again, because all of this is Web3 native for the world, regardless of if it's Web2 or Web3. What we see ourselves is kind of like the security and assurance and trust providers, let's say, for a decentralized environment. It doesn't matter if it's of centralized or decentralized systems or infrastructures, where we actually focus on the security and trust of everything and the proof of state of all the things with post-quantum fingerprints and all the validators, while, you know, existing chains continue to focus on scalability and speed, which is, you know, the focus, right? This is how we see things operating.
Wow. No, it's crazy. And I think one of the, you know, I guess criticisms that I'd like you guys to discuss kind of as we wrap up about like decentralization is that like sometimes it's slower and it'll reduce response time. And, you know, centralization is there because of that scalability dilemma. And so people centralize things because it's more efficient and speedy. Is that a fallacy?
Yeah.
What's your guys' take?
I'll quickly mention DPN here. And of course, it is a fallacy. It's, you know, when you look at any nascent technology, it looks like, oh, you know, this is never going to work. Look at the electric car, you know, it can only drive, I don't know, 30 miles or whatever. You know, it's always like that for any new technology. And then it matures and it's a whole different story. Like, you know, I was going to pull up here our website quickly. And we have basically proven that. So we have 3 months ago, we have started what we're calling our testnet, which is really kind of like a beta mainnet because it has our own chain, our own consensus mechanism operating. And we have 911 nodes that have done more than 86 million post-quantum transactions. If you go back to the Explorer, you'll see the transaction hashes have like 6 pages instead of just one line. So these are post-quantum hashes. If you haven't never seen one, you can go there and check it. And we have, under this environment, which is a decentralized space, mitigated almost 500 million threats just with this specific use case. So we have, just to give you an idea, this is in 3 months. That's more threats mitigated than $100 billion companies out there. I'm not going to mention their names. But this shows you that actually decentralized physical infrastructure or meshes of it, which is our case, are actually way more competent at achieving, you know, high throughput, high speed things than centralized systems. Like if you look, for example, there's so many projects right now, for example, dealing with like distributed storage and computation for AI and many other things also on the DPN space. And you can see like it's so much more efficient. Like it costs you like 100 times less to do the same computation with distributed computation of the participants than it costs you to go to the cloud and do it, right? And the people are still paying for electricity and still they're making money. So it's already happening.
So also, if you look at, say, the early days of computing, like the first 30 years, if you look at the algorithm for data retrieval, it was linear and it was really slow. And it got slower and slower and slower. And then people came up with this concept of having cache. And then you have a hit ratio. So and the same thing happened to the internet, because the internet got really slow about 3 years after it started. And then companies like Akamai came up and started putting like, you know, edge storage around the internet. So you don't really go to the website you're trying to go over 90% of the time because it's cached somewhere. The same thing's going to happen. I mean, we're going to have an incentive to build similar systems, and it's going to make it even faster than it is now. And it's already faster than centralized systems.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And, you know, somebody explained what cache was to me in a very simple thing. They're like, if I asked you like what 165 times 65 was, and I asked you right now, would you be able to figure it out? And like, probably not off the top of my head. I need like a calculator or whatever. He's like, all right, well, I'll tell you the answer is 10,725. Let me ask you the same question. 165 times 65. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well, I know the answer. He's like, yeah, that's what caching is. You put that memory right next to, you know, where it's going to be accessed rapidly and many times. And like we basically did that, you know, not we, but like the people who architected caching and the internet, like they made an algorithm to do that. And I was like, oh wow, that's pretty crazy. And so it's funny you bring that up, because I think a lot of people are like listening, like, oh, cash, like digital cash, like, you know, money. And it's like, no, you're talking about memory is accessed.
C-A-C-H-E. And it's not just memory, it's disk drives. So if you look at, you know, almost any computer, and you actually analyze how many times it's really going to a disk when you think you're going to the disk, that the hit ratio on those things, I don't know, like 96-97%. So that means 96% of the time, whatever you're asking for is already cached. And I'm sure the edge parts of this of the network of the networks cloud, you know, the Azure and AWS. I'm sure their ratio is probably even higher than that.
Actually, that reminds me of, my background is, you know, from a university perspective is IT. And I remember a cash joke that we had, and this was the kind of thing that you would say, and that would be like one person like, ah! And so that's actually similar to what you were saying. And it was something like, why did the CPU break up with the cache? Because it kept bringing up old memories. That's what the cache does.
I love it. No, this has been super fascinating, and it's something that we could, you know, Brandon and I are still trying to learn about quantum resiliency, how it applies to, you know, all of our listeners at the end of the day. And so we really appreciate all of you, you know, all the work that you and your team are doing to push forward quantum resiliency, and for you guys to come on here, the dynamic duo of the Davids here to walk us through. Where could we kind of follow along with the journey? We'll make sure to put these in the show notes. I know you guys are Naris Protocol on X. Any other places? Like David, you mentioned you were blogging quite often, and so on.
Yeah, so a good place to follow us, of course, is at narisprotocol.com or naris.com. There's also our Discord and also our Telegram in there that you can find and participate and participate in different ways, or even join our mainnet, testnet, so on. Our public sale is currently going, so you can also find that information about that all over Twitter and in different locations. Follow up the news around us. There's lots of things, as you said, blogs and videos like this. Of course, you guys are the best, and a number of other publications. There's a lot to follow. There's also peer-reviewed papers with universities and supranational organizations that we have worked with that are also posted in our site and also in publications of that kind of thing. If that tickles your fancy for the 0.1% of people listening, but that's what I would say.
Awesome. Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much for coming on the show. We hope everybody at home listening or watching, whether it's on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you guys are in the world, you're certainly in the right place, because you guys are getting one step closer to mastering your own financial destiny and mastering your own sovereignty with this sort of technology here at Naris Protocol. So everybody watching, thank you for joining. And gentlemen, we'll talk soon.